Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Thank you very much indeed, and good morning to you all, those who are in the room and those who are watching from afar. I didn't realise you were going to be going through the biography. I mean, I chair some meetings as well. A tip is don't do that. Just tell them to read what's in their pack, you know, and those who are interested can have a look at it. It's less embarrassing for the speakers, or more to the point, you mentioned there, there's things that I forget. Where he was once a full-time trainer. I was just trying to work out, early in the session, I became a full-time trainer in 1968. Isn't that frightening? It's worrying, isn't it? But there you go. Anyway, nothing to do this morning, but good morning to you all. A sort of an apology, you should never start with an apology, but a sort of an apology, I'm not particularly sorry about it, but this could be, and some of you might be expecting a technical session on youth contract and work programme, and so we're not going to get it. I am, of course, going to be talking about both, but in a much more generalised positional area, with one or two things, some of it perhaps a bit provocative. But I'm not going to give you a technical presentation on the various strands of youth contract or whatever. To be perfectly honest, if you need that, it's not difficult to find. And looking at the attenders and that this morning, you are all more than capable, if you probably don't know it already, of ascertaining that kind of technical information. What I really want to talk about is why they've been put together, the kind of impact they are having, and whether they're the right things for the future, and put it in that context. And the topic is taking apprenticeships and looking into the future. And I want to major much more on that, and even then go beyond work programme and youth contract, which are very much things of the present and immediate future, and look at some of the other things. Loans was mentioned, we'll be coming on to it, but I should be mentioning it as well, because if we're looking into the future, these are elements we need to be getting our minds around. And I'm sure some of my colleagues here will be picking up some of those points later on. But let's just spend a minute or so anyway on the two big programme areas, and start with the work programme. And I'm going to be a bit critical here of my members, a dangerous thing to do, but they reserve the right to be critical of me, so every now and again I take a risk. And it's quite interesting, because if you look at the prime contractors for the work programme, which I think there's 18 or something of that nature, about 15 of them are members of AELP and are major players in the skills delivery area. And I have to say, and there's another trade association based in this building that majors on the work programme and does a very effective job there, and we work with them, IRSA, and they're based here, and they focus very much on the work programme and the direct links with government, and we've taken a supportive role there, concentrating, if you like, on the skills side of the agenda with BIS and DfE and beyond. I have to say, I think those prime contractors, who invariably are members of the two organisations, have not yet fully, I'm generalising, have not yet fully joined together the work programme with the skills agenda. And yet they're in prime position to do exactly that. They have major contracts with DWP, and they all have, at least the vast majority of the 18, 14, 15 of them, major contracts, national contracts often, with BIS and or DfE. So those are the organisations that we would naturally expect to pull together what AELP has been banging on about for many a long year, which is greater coordination and coherence across government departments on what we believe to be the same agenda, and not separating the so-called employability agenda from the skills agenda. They are not different agendas. They are the same agendas. And the strength of the work programme is it is being delivered primarily through people who are actually engaged in, quotes, both of those agendas. And they are in prime position, and I use the term deliberate in its different ways, to put it together. And that has certainly not fully happened yet. The potential is for that to happen, but it has not happened yet. Because if you take apprenticeships for prime contractors delivering DWP's agenda, the work programme, And this has not been fully grasped other than in perhaps in an intellectual way. It's not, in my view, showing up in activity enough yet, is the apprenticeships should actually be the desired outcome of the work programme. Because the work programme is about getting people who are out of work and been out of work for a long time into sustainable employment. That's not a bad definition for an apprenticeship. So, and we heard much of it. I thought there's some really good setting the scene sessions this morning, very comprehensive. But the concept of an apprenticeship as sustainable employment, we know that most people go through their apprenticeship, we heard the figures this morning, and stay with the employer and go on, or move on to another employer. It really is fantastic foundation work for sustainability. And that, I believe, should be the target for primes to get their charges there at the end of their activity. That, by definition, means that prime contractors should be concentrating on what I'm going to call, and my chairman disagrees with this term, but we ultimately mean the same thing. Prime contractors with DWP funding should be focusing on pre-apprenticeship, getting people ready for work and getting people ready for apprenticeships. And those of you in the room who deal with apprenticeships, which means deal with employers, especially in the current economy, fantastic to see apprenticeships growing, the numbers going. But let's be quite clear, employers are incredibly demanding before they give an apprentice a contract of employment. And why shouldn't they be? I mean, it is a job, always has been a job, it is employment. And employers will rightly say, I want to minimise the risks. We've heard about some of the risks this morning. I want to minimise the risks. And sadly, we do have 1 million young people out of work at the present time. And a lot of older people as well who have the capacity to carry on. And therefore, the work programme, I think, should primarily be looking on using that time and the funding available then, including accessing SFA funding for unemployed, which has grown over recent years, to actually get long-term unemployed people ready to stand a chance at an interview for an apprenticeship all age. And I think it's quite important to keep that age structure open. There's been a lot of pressure on 25 plus and so on. And I think that's that debate has somewhere still to go. But I think it's very, very important that we keep the capacity for apprenticeships all age, not least of all to enable long-term unemployed to get back into the workforce, get up to speed, and then move. And many of them will be way over 25 and need to have that opening for them. So in a sense, that's all I want to say about the work programme. For the work programme providers, who I think are getting there, they're still trying to work out how they mix up their SFA, DfE contracts and DWP contracts. I probably oversimply see it as using the work programme and the monies and the investments available there to move people into contention for an apprenticeship, whatever age, as an absolute key next step to sustainable employment, which, of course, is the government's intention under their welfare reforms. One good thing I'll say about the work programme, which I hope to see infecting the other departments, and we already have one example, I'll come on to it immediately, but we need to go further, is that the work programme is based on the so-called black box approach, where they actually trust providers with a sum of money on success to do whatever they think is appropriate. That is a major step forward from actually government procuring this program and that program and that program, designed this way, designed that way, designed that way. That's what most providers, whether the private sector, the third sector, or colleges in the public sector, have been used to doing. And we've been arguing collectively for some years for more and more flexibility. But one has to say, anyone who's a provider, a prime provider, for work programme has the flexibility that many other people are still arguing for to say, look, you know, we know best, not arrogantly, but we will actually design a programme for this individual which will move them forward. That's a big plus, and I really want to see that infecting DfE and BIS procurement policies over the next couple of years. A couple of words about the youth contract. Some of you might still be hoping this morning, I've told you you're not going to get it, to find out, you know, a description of the youth contract. But of course, I couldn't give that to you even if I intended to, because it's five or six different strands, and all you ought to know is it five or six. To be critical, it's a mishmash of well-intentioned responses to the economic situation and high levels of unemployment, both youngsters and adults. And you get it with every government. This is not a criticism of the current coalition government. For someone who was a full-time trainer in 1968, I've seen an awful lot for a long time. I'll tell you, it happens. There's nothing new in this area of politics. A new government comes in. And if they happen to be on the economic cycle where we're in a dip, then it's absolutely critical they are seen to be taking action. And I'm not arguing with that. I mean, I'm glad to see them doing it. But there is a certain predictability about it. And therefore, we have what is often a mishmash of very focused initiatives. And they are actually a complete reverse of what I've just been arguing for, which is a black box of a sum of money allowing the professionals, the professional intermediaries, to use perhaps a different expression, but providers of all sorts, to actually use their expertise and experience to work out the best program and next step within some broad parameters for the people in front of them. What you now get is a pre-apprenticeship program for long-term unemployed, and the individual's got to be eligible. And you get some grants now for employers. Certain type of grant, if they're 16 to 18, is slightly different if it's 19 plus. And it depends whether they've had an apprentice before, so the employer might not be eligible either. And we've got other providers here. You know, we want the money. We'll make the best of it. My members will make the best of it. Of course we will. We won't knock it. But I'll tell you now, you know, there's three or four more different programs here. And they've got different eligibility requirements. So it takes time checking them out, explaining to the individual, to the employer, why they're not eligible. Guess what you finish up with in that situation? And we've got it with DfE funding at the moment under Foundation Learning. Underspend. How mad is that to finish up with money for people that everyone says is top priority, a million young people out of work, all right? And money made available for it, fantastic, chair of the Treasury. And you finish up with actual or potential underspend or pressure to spend it, it's not going out fast enough and difficult, and finishing up with an underspend of people out there still unemployed. How mad is that? And providers of all sorts know very well that, in fact, if there was a rather broader, more flexible approach for saying this money is now available to deal with a million unemployed and some broad parameters, providers, what can you make of it? I'll tell you now, there won't be an underspend, and I'll tell you now, there'll be more people getting ready for apprenticeships, getting ready for jobs and put into jobs. So at the moment, there's quite a mishmash of well-intentioned government programs under the heading Youth Contract, which is different strands for different groups of people. And I'm afraid my advice is it's well-intentioned, but not the best way to do it. But that's probably on deaf ears for the time being. I will also criticise. I'll understand. I will criticise. Although it may well be a very clever long-term strategy, and I'll share that with you as well. You may make up your own minds. In which case, I'll move perhaps from criticism to even more. Can't think of a word. Congratulations. At the moment, there are several of the youth contract strands which are giving grants to employers. You know, they're actually giving them £1,500 or £2,275, some odd amount. It relates to the national insurance contributions or something. It sounds very odd. But, you know, there's those kinds of money, a couple of £1,000 per person as a direct subsidy. I personally, and I've explained this to ministers and they've listened carefully, but have not accepted my advice. Why should they? That in the long-term strategy, giving employers short-term subsidies is not the right answer for this training business. We've also got masses of evidence, and we've had David Way this morning, held very much within NAS now, masses of evidence that they do use, but we should use even more, to demonstrate to employers they don't need subsidies. This is an investment they cannot afford not to make. You know, and I really think we ought to be collectively pushing money in the education. I don't mean education under DfE for people at school. Educating employers that we now have the evidence from employers that apprenticeship investment by employers is absolutely something they cannot afford not to do if they wish to survive and grow and prosper. That is absolutely there. Therefore, if you start moving into subsidies, you're almost weakening that message. So I think that's the wrong approach. Having said that, if it may well be it's a very clever long-term approach, because, of course, there is an argument to say if you haven't persuaded them yet and you give them some subsidies to bring them into the family so they can taste and see, it may well be that's the way, in fact, you actually do actually convert them into this is something which I'll now take on board myself for the future. So at the moment, I'm sort of sceptical that we're doing it right, but there could be a long-term strategic plan there, which I would have considerably more sympathy for. And I'm not quite sure what it is. The big need, though, and I've mentioned the big plus under the youth programme, which is actually giving providers a black box of flexibility. I won't go back over that again. That really is a big gain. I want to see that related somewhere else, and I'll touch on that in just a minute or so. But the big need, whether it's through the youth contracts in their various forms, or particularly under the work programme, and particularly, and I think it's a real problem at the moment, within SFA funding, is actually having sufficient money for what I'm going to call pre-apprenticeship programmes. And I'm not talking about the formal programme, which is already giving providers problems because of the eligibility requirement. So it's becoming, in some respects, a bit counterproductive in some areas. But I do think we are out of balance. It is fantastic, and I don't understand why David and the government keep using this 450,000 new starts. I did take a flyer. In fact, you heard me do it a couple of months ago, in front of an NAS official and taunted them slightly, but I was delighted to see them use the figure officially either then or very shortly afterwards. Why aren't we actually 450,000 starts last year? I mean, what does that mean? I think it's far more impressive to say that we're now pushing 750,000 apprentices out there as we sit here this morning. It's over 700,000, because I've heard NAS now reluctantly quote that figure. What's the reluctance? You know, if you want to tell the population out there that they're not dead, we still find a few people saying, it's a shame we lost apprenticeships, isn't it? We don't have them anymore. Hang on, we've got 750,000 out there. I think we really need to be pumping that up. But at the moment, all the pressure is on the number of apprenticeships, and I don't knock that, especially looking after the providers where it's core business for most of them, so it's in their interest. But if we're not careful, with a million young people out of work, we are creating a gap between that million people and their suitability for apprenticeships, be they 16-year-olds coming out of school. We heard some of that from Anne Tibble this morning, not ready for the world of work, and her employers continue to complain about the outcomes of full-time education for however many years it is. It's still an ongoing problem. We've got too many young people. We've also got older people because of unemployment, where there's a massive gap between where they are and apprenticeships. And we have not yet got a series of programs. And increasingly, I'm looking at a couple of colleges sat on my left, a real, real, real squeeze in the further education budget, where the one part of the budget which continues to go up is apprenticeships. And for providers of any sort who are involved in them, well, that's good news. But by definition, it means a squeeze on anything else, primarily in the college sector. It actually squeezes even more the capacity to prepare younger and older people to move in there. And I think we have a major problem there, massive need through whatever programme for what I'm going to call flexible pre-apprenticeship work on there. Very, very briefly, I didn't check my watch, but I normally overrun. I'm trying to be very fast talking this morning. I just want to share with you a couple of thoughts. I haven't got time to go into the details. You may want to come back at me at college during a question-answer time, but I'd rather leave you time to do that rather than spout on about things you don't really want to hear about. The future, high-level apprenticeships mentioned this morning, fantastically important, really good initiative. Remember, this group of government ministers, John Hayes particularly, who is obviously pushing this very, very hard, but also David Willetts, who's there looking at the HE brief, and we spent an awful lot of time with them when they were in opposition. And it was only a short time before the general election, which is only just 2 years ago, where talking to both of those potential, as it was then, ministers, they were saying, sort of eyeball to eyeball, apprenticeships, level three is the only thing that counts, level two is not worth anything. And, you know, so, I mean, that's, they were writing policy papers for the election. And we've now moved them. And I'm going to blow my own trumpet slightly. I actually produced for them a paper I wrote in October 1994, and I've kept in a filing cabinet when I was, some mentioned, chairing the Tech National Education and Training Council. And we produced a paper for the then Tory government, which actually was the paper which created modern apprenticeships at level three only. But the paper I produced was for a four-level apprenticeship program. Pre-apprenticeship, a level two, a level three, and a level four plus. And within a very short order, to the credit of this government, they've actually embraced that. And they were a million miles away from that 3 years ago, I'll tell you. In opposition, they were a million miles away from that. And now you've got a massive enthusiasm for level four upwards. Incredibly important. Watch this space. That will really start to use that old-fashioned term, which some people don't like using anymore, start to tackle this parity of esteem issue. Really start demonstrating that work-based learning, learning at work through an apprenticeship program, really does get you level three, level four and beyond, up into HE a bit later on. Tremendous opportunity, which we need to grasp with really, really open arms. And I applaud that entirely. I've said this facetiously for years. I'm now saying it a little bit more seriously, because the time might be right. Are we coming to the time in our dealings with HE and the way we actually present HE as well as non-HE or not immediate HE, recognising the extensive range of work-based learning, which is at the core of a whole range of so-called, wrongly called, academic courses, because HE is called academic, and we start actually recognising that work-based learning in a format which is now identical to apprenticeships is there for teachers, lawyers, accountants, engineers, I mean, and a few others as well. If we can really start recognising that these are not two different things, that in HE, so-called academia, work-based learning on an apprenticeship learn-at-work model has been there for decades, and it's not an either-or, a better or less. It's part and parcel of a whole. I think we're quite close to actually having some serious debates about there, and I look forward to it. Last thing, the big thing we probably can't talk about today, but it takes me into loans, and other people must pick those up afterwards, is another big debate at the core of all this, which this government has started to pick up from a very strange and unexpected angle. Previous government highlighted it but did nothing about it. This government have picked it up bravely, but took me and other people by surprise at where they came in. And it is, who pays for all this? The last government started floating the idea it was a three-way payment system. The state, employers, and individuals. But did nothing about it. This government have come in and grabbed the nettle, and to my surprise, instead of leaning on the employer funding element of it, they jumped into the individual end, which I always thought was the hardest, and have come up with loans. But it mustn't be dealt with in isolation. It has to be seen as a move towards a much broader discussion about who pays for skill development in this country, which everyone agrees is economically incredibly vital for the economy, for the companies, and for all the individuals that work within it. So it does cross them all. And my prediction, not just because of money, of where we're going on all this, and there's some real hard stuff in here, is we are moving. We've got the employer ownership pilots. I haven't got time to go into them. Some strong views on that. But we are moving, I think, into a situation where skill development, the skills needed to do real work, will be more and more placed with employers. It's significantly there now anyway. We don't use the right language, but I think that's going to become clear. I think level two and up developments will increasingly be expecting, through the loans mechanisms, inputs from individuals. We're at level three to start with, 24 plus level three. Don't you think that's it? I think there's going to be a real push. And up to level two, up to basic skills, employability skills, first level twos, up to that level, the state will carry on, I think they will pull back. I'm looking forward now. I think we're really on a move to say the who pays thing is going to be very, very much state paying to get to a certain pretty basic level over and beyond those levels not being reached at school. For some people, schools will get them there, they do now. I think there's going to be greater pressure on direct input from individuals, even down from level two upwards, but with employers increasingly taking the lion's share of the direct skill training. Might be wrong. Whether I'm wrong or right, you'll have some views. You might not like what I say. Time must have run up. Over to you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.